Welcome to Deep Pockets by Petra Söderling, a conversation about governments, technologies, and innovation. The ongoing season, Winter 2023, is loosely based on my upcoming book, Governments and Innovation, The Economic Developer's Guide to Our Future. The book will be available for purchase in Amazon during Q1 2023. Our theme song is by New Orleans jazz icon Leroy Jones. Hi, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode. Today, we're covering a topic that I've been putting off for some time, not because it wouldn't be interesting or important, but actually just the opposite. Cybersecurity is a simple idea in a complex form. It can be approached from so many different angles. It's a protection against threats. It's a competitive advantage. It's a business. It's an enabler for new technologies. Cybersecurity is nothing and everything at the same time. In the studio today, I have someone who moved into this field only recently, but who has exactly the right background to be a visionary in cybersecurity. Danica Hannan has a Bachelor of Science from Iowa State University, which she has put into a very versatile use, spanning across agriculture, data science, AI, banking, quantum computing, and now cybersecurity. Welcome to Deep Pockets, Danica.
Thank you so much, Petra. So glad to be here.
So tell us, how did you become you? Looking at your resume with research projects, I saw places like China, Uganda, India, there's technologies like AI and quantum. There must be a special kind of fire that burns inside of you.
So if I could share a brief story, when I was a little girl, I had a grandma who was a teacher and a great aunt who was also a teacher. And they would always tell me, "Oh, I just love how much you love to learn." And as I was getting ready for this podcast, I realized that I do love to learn. I have a very strong sense of curiosity. And that's led me through the industries that you mentioned, and it's led me to pick up the skill sets that you talked about. And one thing I do want to mention about me is that I'm very data-driven. So throughout this conversation, I'm going to be referencing many different sources, and that comes from my data science background. There's a funny phrase from the industry that I've learned to live by, and that phrase is, "In God we trust, all others must bring data."
Okay. We met at Women in Quantum, or actually we met even before that. I think it was back in 2020. I was a newbie in quantum, and somehow I found you on LinkedIn, and you know, you convinced me that I don't need to worry about the imposter syndrome in quantum. And I'm never so grateful that you did, because I'm just madly in love with this technology. So you're now transitioning from quantum to cybersecurity. What made you want to do this change?
So when I was working for Quantinuum, they're a quantum computing company, I was asked to start focusing on quantum cybersecurity. And when I did that, I really wanted to start to understand the industry. So I started studying for a CompTIA Security Plus certification. That's a very important certification for the cybersecurity industry. I began going to Denver Cloud Security Alliance networking events, and I did informational interviews with industry professionals. Over the course of hours of studying and conversations with experts, my instincts started saying that the timing was right to move into the cybersecurity industry. And once that realization clicked, I started working really hard on making those dreams a reality, and I began pursuing a master's in cybersecurity in January of this year.
Okay. So now you're fresh in cybersecurity. And so tell us, what are the most significant leaps that we're going to see in this field?
I'm most excited about how there's a shift to understand hackers and how they think. And that's being championed by a woman named Kimberly Ferguson Walter. She's a program manager at IARPA. And her goal is to understand how hackers think and what motivates them. So I ran across Ferguson Walter in a Wall Street Journal article, and I Googled her. And I found out that if you look at her profile on Google Scholar, she has 55 publicly available papers that she's contributed to, and she's been publishing research since 2016. Now, one of her papers that really stood out to me was titled "Examining the Efficacy of Decoy-Based and Psychological Deception." In the introduction of the paper, it says, attackers often rely on direct observation of cybersecurity environments. This reliance provides opportunities for defenders to affect attacker perception and behavior by applying the powerful tools of defensive cyber deception. Then in the conclusion, she goes on to say, the study demonstrates that an effective deception solution has the potential to force attackers to waste time, resources, and mental effort, and perhaps trigger early warnings on zero-day attacks for which typical network defenses are unprepared. Even if one APT finds a way to avoid the effects of deception, these defenses can still help protect a network against other attackers. So what I love about what she's doing is how she's bringing psychology into cybersecurity and how she's really driving a push at the highest levels of government to understand how hackers think. Now, what's cool is that Amazon is already doing work with this, and they have a very good example where they look at the motivation of hackers through four different lenses. So they view attackers as people who are driven by ego, money, ideology, or coercion. And Amazon cyber defense teams will use that assessment to predict a hacker's likely skills and the kind of risks that they're willing to take. So for instance, a hacker who's after money can be easy to figure out because they're going to attempt to access systems to obtain data or to use computers for other purposes like mining cryptocurrency. And that lets their cyber defense teams be really smart and strategic about how they're defending Amazon, and they can make sure they go after the highest level threats. So that's what I'm most excited about, is seeing cybersecurity become more human and start to understand who's using these tools and how are they using them so that we can build better defenses.
That is so fascinating. It's like when you're putting together a cybersecurity team, you not only need to hire engineers, you need to hire psychologists and other social, professionals. That is so exciting. Let's move on to national security. Technology development has changed the world in many ways, and countries must prepare for cyber attacks and threats, as you talked about. The pace of advance is fast, so there's no time to waste. If we think about the U.S., where do you see the most important cyber threats in the near future?
I see our biggest threat as the problem we have with talent shortages. So this is a global issue, but we'll start by looking at the U.S. first. There is this great report that came out from this group called the Federal Cyber Workforce Management and Coordinating Working Group. They were established in 2019, and they're an interagency coordinating body that collaborates on common cyber workforce challenges. And if you look at them, they've brought together a very diverse set of people who can really see broadly across the U.S. government and the federal space, and they've got quite a bit of depth too. This working group is comprised of 24 federal departments and agencies, and they consist of over 250 workforce management professionals, human resource specialists, and cyber hiring managers. To your point about diversity, this is a group that's really well positioned to deeply understand the needs of the federal cybersecurity space. They did an analysis of the current state of the federal cyber workforce, and they found some things that are pretty alarming if you dig into the findings. So the first one is that there's nearly 40,000 cyber job openings in the public sector. And when we switch to talking about this internationally, 40,000 is not going to seem like a large number in just a moment, but that's still a big deficit. So you're missing 40,000 people. That need is likely going to grow in the coming years. And if you look into that even further, less than 6% of their cyber workforce is under the age of 30. That makes me very concerned about the talent pipeline. That tells me that they're not bringing in enough new recruits. And then if we look at the other side of their talent pool, more than 30% of their cyber workforce is over the age of 55. A lot of that talent is going to start aging out. They're going to take tribal knowledge with them. They're going to take decades of work experience that's incredibly valuable. So if you look at that end-to-end of how the workforce coming in is very small and the most mature, experienced part of the workforce is going to be aging out within the next 10 to 15 years, I'm very concerned about the talent when it comes to cybersecurity. Then if we look at this at an international level, there's this very well-respected group. They're called the International Information System Security Certification Consortium, or ISC Squared for short. And every year they put out a cybersecurity workforce study. I pulled up their study for 2022, and it said that for 2022, They estimate that globally, there's about 4.6 million people who are working in cybersecurity. On the face, that's a fantastic number. You know, there's a lot of people in cybersecurity. We need that talent. But then on the very next page of this report, it starts to talk about the talent shortfall. So they say that we've got 4.6 people globally working in cybersecurity, but we have a shortfall of about 3.4 million people. That's nearly one-to-one. That's very concerning. So not only did ISC Squared dig into the numbers of how many people do we have, how many people do we need, they took the analysis a step further and they started asking the question of, okay, so what are the impacts of these talent shortfalls? And they asked people about which of the following have you experienced that you feel would have been mitigated if you had enough cybersecurity staff? One of the first things that popped up was not enough time for proper risk assessment and management. Another one was slow to patch critical systems. And the third one that really stuck out to me was not enough time to adequately train each cybersecurity team member. So just starting with the first one, of that risk of not having enough time to do a proper risk assessment and management, that is deeply concerning. Because if you don't understand the risks that you have in your organization, how can you build a good defense strategy? And then being slow to patch critical systems. You know, there's such an urgency of every time a new flaw or a vulnerability is found that as soon as there's a patch, you need to get it in place to guard yourself. But if you can't shore up your defenses as quickly as you need to, you're leaving that door open for hackers to take advantage.
That is very alarming. As an American, as a European, as you know, a person on this planet, you know, everything that you just said is pretty worrying. If we continue on the international theme, there are different stages or situations in developing and implementing cybersecurity in different countries. You know, superpowers are the leaders. Some countries, some other countries might lag very much behind. So how do you see, if you compare the strengths of the superpowers in cybersecurity, what's the U.S. doing best? On the other hand, where should we keep an eye on our adversaries?
I'm going to look at this through a lens of quantum cybersecurity. And here's where the U.S. is doing really well. We're aligning public and private interests. So if we look at the Quantum Computing Cybersecurity Preparedness Act, one of the mandates is that the White House said we need to create guidance for assessing critical systems. And this has to get done within the government 1 year after the National Institute of Standards and Technology issues their planned post-quantum cryptography standards. So the White House is saying, okay, we know that this quantum cybersecurity threat is coming. We're going to start preparing for it. One of the first things that we need to do is we need to figure out, what are our critical systems? How does this stuff all fit together? I completely agree with that. What's really interesting to me is that the private sector is very much aligned with the government in this space. So there's a group called the Cloud Security Alliance. They're an international team of cybersecurity experts. They're very well respected in their space. They put out a guide on the practical preparations for the post-quantum world, and they actually recommend a similar approach. So this is on one of the first few pages of the report. It's included in the executive summary because it's so important. They say for private companies, their post-quantum mitigation plan needs to have 5 stages to it. First one is education awareness. Second is create a post-quantum project. The third is take a data protection inventory. So very similar to the government, they're saying, hey, private companies, you need to figure out what you need to protect from the quantum threat. Stage 4 is analysis, and then only at stage 5 do they say that we need to be implementing post-quantum mitigations. I was really pleased to see that the government and public interests are aligned on this, because especially in the U.S., that doesn't always happen. Now, that being said, I am concerned that we're falling behind in terms of funding. There's a group that's called the Quantum Resources and Careers, or QRECA, and they have a very nice map that shows how much governments are spending on quantum computing from a global standpoint. And their map shows that the U.S. is investing $1.2 billion on quantum initiatives, while China's investing $15 billion. So I know it's a very common concern within the community is that we're falling behind in terms of funding. But it makes me pause whenever I see that figure of wondering how much is that lack of investment going to hurt us down the line? So on the good side, the public and private spaces are aligned. something that does very much concern me is, are we putting enough resources into this compared to other countries?
That's a really good point. So actually, my next question is on international collaboration. If we think that, you know, you're worried that the US is not putting enough money into this, maybe by collaborating with other countries, it's going to help us, it's going to help them. So collaborating in data intelligence, could the US maybe export cybersecurity technology and knowledge to other countries and work with them?
So from a defensive standpoint, this is a very straightforward question. Yes, we'll absolutely see tools and data being increasingly shared. A great example of this is what's going on with the Ukrainian-Russian war. So there was a New York Times article that came out on February 28th, 2022. That's just a few days after Russia physically invaded Ukraine on February 24th, 2022. A very fast turnaround time. The New York Times is the third largest newspaper in the U.S. It's very widely read. And I'll share a few paragraphs from this article about how Microsoft jumped into the war. Last Wednesday, a few hours before Russian tanks began rolling into Ukraine, alarms went off inside Microsoft's Threat Intelligence Center, warning of a never-before-seen piece of wiper malware that aimed at the country's government ministries and financial institutions. Within 3 hours, Microsoft threw itself into the middle of a ground war in Europe, from 5,500 miles away. The Threat Center, north of Seattle, had been on high alert, and it quickly picked apart the malware, named it Foxblade, and notified Ukraine's top cyber defense authority. Within 3 hours, Microsoft's virus detection systems had been updated to block the code, which erases or wipes data on computers in a network. Then Tom Burt, the senior Microsoft executive who oversees the company effort to counter major cybersecurity attacks, contacted Ann Nurberger, the White House's deputy national security advisor for cybersecurity and emerging technologies. Ms. Neuberger asked if Microsoft would consider sharing details of the code with the Baltics, Poland, and other European nations, out of fear that the malware would spread beyond Ukraine's borders, crippling the military alliance or hitting West European banks. Before midnight in Washington, Ms. Neuberger had made introductions, and Microsoft had begun playing the role that Ford Motor Company did in World War II, when the company converted automobile production lines to make Sherman tanks. There is so much to unpack there. So it's just amazing how quickly the private sector got into this. They reached out to the White House top officials. They reached out to foreign interests and allies. They mitigated a lot of the damage that could have gone on had this cybersecurity weapon not had immediate defenses built up in place. And Microsoft openly blogged about this on their website. So from a defensive standpoint, it's very easy to justify why we're going and helping our allies, and why we're sharing tools. But things get trickier when it comes to offensive tools. So Petra, have you ever heard about a tool called Project Pegasus?
No.
So Pegasus is a cybersecurity tool that was built by former Israeli intelligence operatives, and it's considered military-grade surveillance software. The bright side of Pegasus is that it's been used to bring down Mexican cartels. And when it's used right, it can be used by foreign law enforcement and intelligence agencies as a means to combat terrorism, drug trafficking, and other major crimes. And so that's what it's supposed to be licensed for officially. And Pegasus can get into a target's smartphone without requiring the user to click a link to activate the malware. And once it's installed, Pegasus can collect all the device's data undetected. That's everything from call records, being able to read text messages, and get location information. But the problem is that Pegasus has a documented track record of being abused. It's been used to track journalists, politicians, and business people all over the globe. And that's been reported on by groups like the Pegasus Project. And they're an international team of journalists who are committed to getting stories out to the public. And Pegasus Project has reported that journalists have been targeted and killed as a result of this software. So this has also been reported on by Amnesty International Security Lab, and they analyzed phones that were hacked by Pegasus. They analyzed about 150 phones. They found that roughly half of them had been infected by this software without the journalists knowing, and it compromised the journalist and all their sources.
That is a fantastic story. Thank you so much for sharing it. We're going to need to wrap up there. Thank you for visiting Deep Pockets, Danica Hannan. It was great to have you.
Thank you so much, Petra.
You've listened to Deep Pockets by Petra Söderling. To subscribe to content and to pre-order the book Governments and Innovation, The Economic Developer's Guide to Our Future, please go to petrasoderling.com. The wonderful music you heard is by Leroy Jones, an iconic New Orleans Jazz Hall of Fame trumpetist. You can find this and other Leroy Jones tunes at your favorite online or offline music store. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe, like, rate, and share our episodes. It means a lot to me. Thank you.